Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to another episode of Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to center the child in all conversations about marriage, family, and beyond. I'm so glad that you're giving some of your weekend to us. I know that those times are precious, and your attention is one of your most valuable resources, and that you're giving us 1 hour of it means an awful lot to me. We've got a lot to discuss on the show today, but I want to begin by talking about Hurricane Helene and the impact that that has had, especially on the residents of North Carolina. Some of our Them Before Us staff is in Charlotte and have been pretty integrally involved in trying to get relief to people on the ground. One of those people is my executive director, Josh Wood, who joins us. So Josh, there are some pretty appalling, astonishing, horrifying images coming out of North Carolina. You know, some numbers in terms of the death toll that you feel are pretty undercounted at this point. So what are you hearing from friends, and what have you been involved with just in terms of trying to get some relief to these desperate people?
Yeah, this has been an odd and very difficult, you know, last 7 or 8 days. My background, just a little explanation. I did my graduate work in humanitarian disaster leadership. So I got involved more with Them Before Us and working with the family, because I do think the family is your source of resilience and strength, even in the most difficult times. And I think strong families make strong communities. But I've done a lot of work on responding in these types of situations, disasters, helping, building communities, building resilience within communities. And, you know, what we saw with the hurricane is typical of the media in one sense. And I'm not here to bash the media and say that they, you know, are purposefully not covering this or something like that. But by way of resources, you typically do during a hurricane have most of your reporters on the coast. You've got the storm surge, you've got the beach there, and very few people are inland. So in this case, same thing happened. A lot of the rain, I mean, 40 trillion gallons, if you can believe that, fell in the southeast. And a lot of it happened in communities in Appalachia, specifically Western North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee, that really were not prepared for something like this. It's been awful. I mean, me and some of my friends, we just felt compelled to help, and we've been organizing a response from a lot of the churches trying to help get into Asheville and some of the other cities affected, working with a couple of organizations on the Tennessee side too to help, just to respond. But what are we seeing? We're seeing communities wiped off the face of the earth, to be quite honest. Really small Appalachia towns that are just gone. They were there, and there's really just debris now.
Yeah. Some of the reports, you know, initially is that, you know, there's been 125 dead from the storm so far. But then just one small town hospital is listing 400 just in their hospital. And I know that you've gotten some disturbing calls in terms of how to deal with the volume of people who have passed away that these communities just aren't prepared for. So what do you think we're going to see when it comes to like the ultimate toll on loss of life?
Yeah, I think we have gotten people who are just in passing saying to us, there's this many at this hospital, this many in this, you know, disaster zone. And there's just absolutely no way 125 is right. I think this is going to absolutely balloon. Ron DeSantis put it well that if you picture, you know, Florida, he said, we've got ability to get to people from a number of different directions. Imagine being on a million little islands. And that's what North Carolina is dealing with. We're up in the mountains. There are people, roads completely demolished, guys hiking 10, 12 miles to find their elderly parents. Again, it is really, really rough. And it might be okay for the person that can survive 2-3 days with very little water. But for someone who needs treatment every single day, who needs meds, their timeline becomes very, very short to live. And that's why there's just such an onus right now in getting materials and supplies in most of the time by air right now. That's been some of the most effective early response.
Yeah, I just can't imagine. You know, it's so interesting because right now the story is at number 21 on the New York Times. And even though it's expected that when the damage is totally assessed, Helene will be one of the top five or higher most destructive hurricanes in our history. Do you have some thoughts about why this isn't getting more national attention?
Oh, maybe. It's hard. I think Appalachia is, you know, East Tennessee, Western North Carolina. It hasn't gotten a lot of coverage. I don't know if it's just not interesting to people. I don't know if that's just our state as a nation that we just turn the channel and we're really tired of hearing about loss. Maybe it's overwhelming for people. I saw an interview where someone was talking about the bodies are in trees. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Like sometimes that does cause people just to turn away. And so my most benevolent reading wants to be that people just don't want to look at the destruction and death and they want to turn to stuff that's lighter. But, you know, I think my philosophy has been, even as we've tried to get involved and get supplies into that part of the country, just our neighbors. I mean, I live in Charlotte. That's just 2 hours away. My response has been, you know, you do have to look at this stuff. You do have to stare at it, do what you can, because there are so many people who don't have the ability to not look. And so it's kind of incumbent on us, neighbors, friends, our churches, every church I know is doing a drive right now around North Carolina. I've had friends on the East Tennessee side who said Sam's Club, Costco, there's not a single diaper, there's not a single supply that hasn't been purchased and given out to that part of the community. You know, it's part of who we are as Americans that we are generous people. We don't rely on the government to fix everything. I'd love for the government response to be strong, but this is also something that neighbors are feeling a responsibility to do individually. And I think that's what we have to do. And nationally, we can't turn away. We need to raise money, awareness, spend time thinking about how do we make this community more resilient for the next 500-year flood, which seems to happen more often than that these days.
Yeah. You know, we tend to start off Them Before Us Radio with some Bible time. We wanted to kind of discuss this pretty pressing humanitarian crisis first, especially because you've been pretty involved just on what might be considered a small scale in terms of trying to provide relief. But the thing is that I think that there's good men and women that are in proximity doing a lot of that on a small scale. And it somewhat ties into the portion of my Bible reading this week that really stood out to me. And it's not from Exodus that I'm doing in my individual study. I'm reading a book of the Bible with each of my sons in the morning at different times. And my 14-year-old and I are going through the book of 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy. And it's been fascinating to me because when you read it with a young man, especially, what you see is you are about to see some of the best character outlines, some of the best list of criteria for what constitutes not just a good adult, but a good man. What does it take to be a good man? And honestly, that is hard to find today because you go to these two terrible extremes of sort of machismo, dominant, you know, alpha, and then swing over to like subservient, weak, beta. And the world is so damaged by either of those non-masculine extremes. But Timothy, you know, which is a book written by a spiritual father to a spiritual son, actually gives us some of the criteria that we need to all be aiming for, but I think especially men need to hear. So what does Paul tell Timothy in chapter 3 in terms of what he should be striving for? What the quote-unquote top men, the one that have the most authority, the most responsibility, the one that have the most level of leadership. What should their lives look like? A lot of it looks like the kind of relief that you have been able to provide, but a lot of it also helps young men especially have a picture of what they should become, even if they weren't able to behold that kind of example in their own life, like Timothy. You know, Timothy sounds like he had a dad, but it wasn't a dad that developed him the kind of spiritual formation that he was going to need to lead a church. So this is what 1 Timothy says. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, a pastor, a leader, he desires a noble task. So it's good. It is good to aspire to lead. It is good to try to work and aim and advance yourself in these areas of leadership. So what do you want in those kinds of men? To be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money, managing his own household well with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone doesn't know how to manage his own household, how's he going to care for God's church? So I've been reading this with my 14-year-old, and after each one of those qualifications, I say, stop. What is he talking about? What does that mean? And my son, my 14-year-old, it's interesting because he'll say, oh, it looks like that. And he'll start to name the men who have exemplified it. And a lot of that is because I think all of us can read something on paper, but because we're humans, it does not impact us until it is embodied. We need to see it lived out through somebody else. It's not enough for me when I was young to hear a woman say, well, a woman needs to learn in all quietness and submission. She needs to have a gentle, quiet spirit. And I went, well, I'm sunk, baby. I'm not quiet. It was helpful for me to have a woman say, it's not saying you never talk, Katie. It's saying your spirit is quiet. You know, you're not there to disrupt unless it's like godly troublemaking, which I've learned is should also probably be listed as a fruit of the spirit. But it's interesting because he was listening to these qualifications. I'm like, what does it mean to be sober-minded? We'd talk about it and I'd say, who's sober-minded? He would give an example of somebody that he knows, a man that he knows that sees the world as it is, who doesn't look away when there's a crisis, but also doesn't exaggerate that crisis and instead sees it clearly so he can move into action on behalf of not only managing himself, managing his household, but also managing the people under his charge. So I just want to thank you because I think that that's what you're doing in your own capacity, your limited capacity, kind of gives us another embodied picture of masculinity. But I'm also going to feed this into the second story that we want to briefly touch on. And that is this crazy resurgent of religion, specifically church attendance among young men. So what's going on with that, Josh?
Well, I think the article New York Times talks all about how Gen Z young men are more religious than young women. And I think that this ties into even the disaster, is that young men want to be needed, to be a part of something bigger than themselves, and they want a burden to shoulder that is going to make others better, that's going to make their community better. They want to see the fruit of that. And that is, in a nutshell, what Christianity calls us all to. And I think that's what you're seeing, is in a culture that's become very me-centric and has feminized a lot of men and asked them to tone down the things that God gave them to be good at, to be different in. Again, we had line workers working all evening around our house, and they were all these young men, and they came to our house, and Savannah, my 6-year-old, said, how come there are no girls? I said, well, because God made men strong, and this is very dangerous, and there are some girls that do this work. I've looked it up. I think there's 197 line workers that are females out of 120,000 in the U.S. This is Siri and Google. Don't fact check me. But it's obviously a male-dominated industry, because men are strong and they're willing to take risks and sacrifice, and this is the way they're called. In a different way, my wife took risks all through the pandemic as a nurse. It's not that she's not brave and courageous, it's just different. And so I had to take and said, there's not a lot of male nurses, but they're different. God created them differently. They have different gifts. We're made to take on burdens and sacrifice. I do believe that. And I think we as, you know, young men, I think we enjoy and find home, a home in Christianity, because it does call us to something bigger than just the end of our own pleasures. And that's something that the world does not offer.
Yeah, I agree. And I look at the world, I mean, I'm online a lot, and I'm online through the eyes of my kids as well. Like, I see what they're seeing. We watch movies together. It is very rare for any outlet to give an accurate picture of masculinity, both its pitfalls, but its incredible aptitude and potential. And I think that young men are gravitating towards church and Christianity specifically because it's telling them the truth about themselves. Yeah, they've got some appetites that can absolutely wreck them, but with the power of God in them, they can become a force for good in a way that nothing else can. Stay with us. We're going to talk about the VP debate up next.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us. I am joined by my executive director, Josh Wood. We're going to talk about the VP debate that happened this Tuesday night. And coming off of a segment where we just talked about masculinity and true masculinity, we got to hear the debate between two different men, I'd say very different men. And I think, you know, when I picture like presidential campaigns, I think that there is so much that goes into like, who are you going to be? What are you going to project to the world? You know, what is the image that we want you to embody as we try to pitch you to the American public? And it's interesting because I feel like we had a tale of two men on the stage on Tuesday. You know, I think that one way that the Harris campaign has wanted to pitch VP candidate Tim Walz is sort of as this lovable, kind of down to earth, like small town America's dad kind of image. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, with J.D. Vance, the Harris campaign tried really hard right out of the gate to frame him as a weird guy, which is so bizarre to me, because if you want to look at everybody's lives between like the two candidates for president and the two VP, like Vance is the most normal of all of them, like grew up like legitimately working class, overcome a lot of challenges, went to college, got married, has never divorced, has got two little kids. So it was interesting to me. I'm like, what are just the stories of masculinity that are coming out of this debate? But what I saw and what I appreciated is I liked that it seemed to be a civil debate. There were very clear differences in what the candidates were presenting, but I guess I want to start out by saying I appreciated the tone. And there were times where both of these men, even though they were pushing very different policy agendas, and even though I'm sure that they were coached by their respective camps to come in and destroy the opposition, they were civil. They found some areas of agreement. That said, I think it was pretty clear that J.D. Vance came out as the victor in that, you know, VP contest. But overall, I think that it was a good debate. What did you think, Josh?
So when we talked about Trump versus Harris, we agreed, I think, that as a performance, Harris did better. She stuck to her game plan and really threw Trump off. But I would say even in victory there, a little Pyrrhic, it talked about nothing. I really felt like we got fact checks, we got some pivots, we got spin. And I felt like even if you did declare a winner in that one, you weren't necessarily even winning something. There wasn't like you weren't able to get your platform out. We didn't get a better idea of what people planned to do. In this one, when we talk about winners and losers for this, I do think on the whole, you did get a better picture from both sides on what they would do. And then, yes, I think strategically, even in a talking performance, I thought Vance did a really good job of being clear. I will say there was a couple parts where I thought that he didn't answer the question directly that I wish he would have. But he looked just a lot more comfortable in general on the stage than Walz did. I'll also say that I'm with you. The tone, the kind of cordiality between the two was markedly different than something we've seen in a long time. I posted something on my Instagram a couple days ago of a clip from Romney and Obama back in the day. And it starts with like Romney saying, you know, congratulations, you and Michelle, you've been married, you know, X number of years. How exciting. Just wanted to start the date off by saying congratulations. I saw you celebrated your anniversary. I'm like, that felt like it might as well have been Civil War news. Like it was that long ago. Like how, and to see a little bit of that now again, just where, hey, I think we agree a little bit on this. Hey, yes, I agree on federal regulations are a little bit, you know, cumbersome at the state level. It was like, wow, maybe we are, it's possible. There's like hope. We can get back to that someday.
Yeah. I appreciated that. I do feel that one thing that I noticed is Vance was very comfortable on that stage and Walz wasn't. And I think a lot of that is because Vance is going into this already understanding that He is going up against hostile moderators. He has a media culture that is slanted against him. And he has already had a lot of experience doing battle against people that would refute or challenge his ideas. Walls has not done that. He's either That's chosen true. Not to, or he hasn't been forced to do it. And in that sense, I was like, Vance, I get you, baby. I know exactly what you're saying. And I think that most, I mean, I don't know where it is, how it is where you guys live. If maybe you're in a town where everybody largely agrees with you, that is not where I live. I live in Seattle. There is no friendly outlets up here. I mean, save for a few talk show hosts. There's, I can just assume that if I'm at the gym or at the restaurant or walking around on the golf course, watching my kid, you know, hit a few rounds in his competition, that if I'm walking next to a parent, if I were to tell them how I feel, they would grill me. So I am actually always ready, not always, but I tend to be much more ready to defend my position, to have responses, because I've had to practice, I've had to prepare, because I don't automatically assume that I'm going to get the soft touch, that I'm going to get the friendly response, that I'm going to get the kid gloves. And there is something about kind of representing a minority viewpoint that forces you to be better prepared. I think you absolutely saw that with Vance. I mean, Vance has done, I don't know, 70 interviews at this point since it's become, I think Walls has done less than 10. And so there is just a comfort of saying, look, I have to regularly defend my position. And so as a result, I'm better prepared, not just in substance, because Vance absolutely was. He was ready at every turn. But I will tell you, in tone, and this is something else that I've learned, is when I get into heated, contested conversations, whether they are personal or whether they are online, where there's a lot of different people watching a Twitter exchange, there is one rule that I've learned that I try to hold myself to, not always, certainly don't do it perfectly, is try to be the most beautiful person in the conversation. Make sure that my tone does not set up any stumbling blocks. What I'm going to say is hard for people to hear. Hey, don't make babies in the laboratory. Or, well, I'm sorry, I don't think that you should get divorced because it could hurt your kids' lives. What I'm about to say is hard enough. I should not add additional stumbling blocks because of my tone. And I think J.D. Vance did an incredible job last night having a tone of beauty, understanding, conciliation wherever possible. I mean, he would weave in his own personal story, empathy for people going through the struggles. And he would not, well, there were a few times he did, but generally he did not flinch. He didn't pull punches when it came to critiquing the policies and the bad ideas.
Well, and to speak to, you know, their decisions and posture through the debate, I thought one thing that stuck with me, again, you get, this was a deep debate and there were 4.5 people watching. I mean, this is like for the wonks. This is for the people who really care. And I'm not ashamed to say I was one of them. What stuck with me, even with all the substance, they confronted Walls pretty directly on his claim to have been in Tiananmen Square. And he just kind of said, he didn't even say he misspoke. He just kind of danced around it and said, I was almost there. I kind of was there. And did not just say, look, I misspoke. I didn't say the right thing. That's on me. I'm sorry. Now on the flip side, one thing that stuck with me, and I saw a lot of outlets posting this yesterday and today, was when they asked Vance if Trump lost the 2020 election. And he completely deflected with a legitimate point that there was censorship. They buried the Biden laptop, some legitimate grievances, but wouldn't just answer, did they win or lose? And I personally wish he would have had the you know, I'd say both of them. I personally wish both of them would have just owned it and said, again, if Vance has problems with the way that mail-in, you know, voting was just absolutely pushed through so many states at the last minute. If you've got, you know, problems with them not clearing voter rolls ahead of time, if you've got a problem with them not doing ID checks ahead of time, if you want to say that the laptop suppressed votes when it was very, very tight, all these different things. I'm like, maybe that's an opportunity. Although that was 2016 with the laptop. I'm like, there's things to point to say, I think it influenced the outcome unfairly, but to say, to be unable to just say we lost, I think that'll stick with the American people. I don't think that played well for him, in the same way that Walls being unable to say, yeah, I haven't told the truth or I misspoke, is starting to become a narrative for him with his military service and saying he carried guns into combat and saying he did IVF when he didn't. That's becoming a bit of a line thing for him too.
Yeah, I think that both sides will be able to pull some fodder for themselves out of different quotes from the respective candidates. The debate did get down to some issues that really matter to children as well. So let's talk a little bit about that. Honestly, one of the most skilled responses that I saw was Vance's answer around immigration. And this is something that if you've been listening to Them Before Us Radio, you're familiar with. You know, we've got a chapter on immigration and border security in our new book, Pro-Child Politics. We've allowed you to listen to an episode 5, an entire segment interviewing the author of that chapter, Laura Reese from the Heritage Foundation. I have read through this chapter on immigration with my 18-year-old daughter, who's very interested in combating human trafficking. And I said, girl, if you want to do something about trafficking, you've got to understand immigration policy. And so I actually feel like, you know, the left leaning media, and certainly the moderators last night, you know, tried to talk about immigration. And I think it came up like, oh, well, if we deport people, aren't we going to have family separation? And Vance got right to the point and said, oh, you want to talk family separation? Oh, you want to talk about kids being separated from their mom and dad? That is the current policy that right now, as it has come out and repeatedly been verified over the last several months, the immigration services have lost track of 30 to 300,000 children. They don't know where they are, that came across the border as unaccompanied minors. The reality is many of them will never see their mother and father again. Many of them never made it to a relative. Many of them were trafficked into the seedy underground of you know, child slavery in this country because of the Biden-Harris policies around the border. An unsecured border is not just bad for U.S. kids because it damages their economy, it damages their security, it redirects resources away from them and towards immigrants, many of whom should not be here, many of whom are criminals. And I say that because that just came out this morning that, you know, we are now talking about, I think, 500,000 illegal people who are here who do have criminal backgrounds. So it's not just a threat to the U.S. kids. Our current immigration policy is a threat to immigrant children, and they are being trafficked at rates we really cannot count or quantify because we don't even know that they're coming across the border a lot of the time. So I am grateful that that was highlighted. Did you have thoughts on the exchange that the two had about immigration?
Yeah, if there was really a genuine concern about the safety and well-being of children, it would be mirrored in the number of kids that have been lost by this administration. So if it's not really about that, what is the reason for bringing up this very real problem of potentially deporting people who are not citizens and them having to leave kids here who have been born here and have been granted citizenship by being born here? Well, it seems to me like this becomes a real sticking point that with every single day that passes, as hundreds of children are born every single day, it becomes more and more untenable to return to a place of having no illegal immigration within our borders. So who benefits from the chaos? Who benefits from this can being kicked down the road? If I take us here to 1 year where there's 2 million more immigrants and there's been 365 days of people having more children, then this doesn't become 11 million like it was back when we were having this debate in 2012 or 2016. Well, it becomes 20, 25 million eventually. Well, if 11 million was an unprecedented number to deport and there was going to be 6 million, you know, family separations, what is 25 million? It's unthinkable. It's irresponsible. And, you know, that would be the words used. And so for me, it points out that I think it's starting to look like chaos is the goal to create an untenable situation where a pathway to citizenship becomes the only humane response. And you're going to get growing support as the number grows. And that's concerning to me.
As pretty much every author in Pro-Child Politics points out, all of these are major problems that we're dealing with today. And it is going to be painful to address them. Or we can delay, defer, and ignore, and the problems will only be greater for our children and grandchildren to address. Another major area that came up in the debate last night was the topic of abortion. And I want to get your thoughts on this, but I saw this very interesting map of top search political issues by state ahead of the October 2024 vice presidential debate. And it just kind of shows the map across the country of what people were Googling. The top answers were crime, social security, healthcare, unemployment, and abortion. And abortion was only in Georgia. That was only the top search in Georgia. After the political debate on Tuesday, the top search political issue by state was abortion. That was the thing that everybody was Googling in every state across the country. So what did you think about the exchange that the two had on abortion?
There are pros and cons. Pros and cons. So I think that Vance tried to paint a different picture than conservatives have painted in the past. With, again, some good and bad. He wanted to emphasize that we as conservatives have to create an environment where people are more confident in their ability financially, economically to raise children, that they aren't fearful of the burden of starting a family, that mortgages are going to be too high, that food's too high, that they're going to make their kids suffer in an untenable financial situation. Good. I think that is something we should communicate. And by the way, pregnancy resource centers, majority of which have been started by churches, outnumber abortion clinics by a 3 or 4 to 1 margin. So don't ever tell me that the church hasn't stepped up to provide healthcare in a way that secular society has not. Christians have been there. They'll continue to be there. But getting the narrative out there in the media, good thing. I didn't love that Vance stepped away from the fact that abortion shouldn't be a state's rights issue because it's a human rights issue and we have the right to life within our Constitution. That shouldn't be infringed. Those babies in the womb are citizens. They're people. We need to protect them. And I don't like that we backed away from that. The downside here is that that didn't play well against Walls, who's saying, let the woman decide, she can do whatever she wants. But he kind of saved it a little bit by going back to saying, what was your born alive bill? Please talk about that. And he did not. Walls deflected, because he didn't want to say, yes, I was responsible for changing the bill so that doctors could leave the baby to die on the table.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. Thanks for spending some time with us talking about the VP debate, both the things that could be commended and the things that need to be critiqued. And that's pretty easy to do when the situation is not up close and personal, when we are talking about somebody else, how they should have answered a question, what kind of policy that they should be advancing. When it comes to how we live out these child-centric principles in our own lives, sometimes it's messier. Sometimes we don't exactly know what to do when the ideal rubber meets the real life road, if you want to put it that way. And so that's why we devote the last third of Them Before Us Radio to talking about what do we do in real life? We want to answer your questions, the one that you have sent in through the week. And as always, I've got my training director, Jen Friesen, to help me here. She's going to share some of the questions you have sent in to the show as you've listened to a lot of this child-centric content. So Jen, thanks again. And tell us what people are asking.
Hey, Katie. Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me back. Yeah. So let's see. Justin's question is, what should we do when a teacher's pushing things we don't agree with on our kids? For example, having our kid repent basically of their skin color because of the horrible things people sharing the same skin color have done in the past.
So this is very challenging. And I write this as somebody who co-authored a book called Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City. My co-author Stacy and I have raised our kids in woke Seattle, largely in public schools, and we have had to confront all kinds of bad ideas coming down upon our kids from their teachers, whether it is writing a more equitable constitution or whether it is going through Black Lives Matter curriculum that advances a lot more than just racial equality. Sometimes it's hard to know exactly what to do. I would say that you want to stratify your response based on your child's developmental stage. So in elementary school, my advice would be, if your elementary school teacher is talking to your child about this, doing something that really goes against not just your worldview, but what I would say is the fundamental principles of justice as it relates to what it means to be a human and how to properly understand what it means to be a human in the real life world in relation to the people around us, I would say you go directly to the teacher, like privately, so that there isn't an audience, and directly confront them and say, what it is you're asking my child to do is immoral. Hopefully you're going to come well informed. Hopefully you're going to be very calm about it. You're going to make a reasoned case about why it is that having your child feel guilty for not a characteristic that they have chosen or cultivated, not a sin that they have committed, but simply the inherent nature of their maleness or their whiteness, or maybe even their faith. So that needs to be confronted. If your child is older, if they are a middle schooler, my approach would be, hey, what do you want me to do here? How do you want me to help you? Because I want to equip you to be able to stand firm and push back against this. What does that look like? Do you want to do some research together and then you can formulate a response? Do you want me to go with you to talk to the teacher or bring this to the principal? When it comes to your high schooler, that's where I'd say, I want to function as a consultant. Obviously, you have an alarm that has rung inside of you that this isn't right. You want to do something about it. I am here to fortify you. So I try to do that with each of my kids, really just intervene on their behalf in elementary school and middle school, assist them, and then in high school, consult with them. And I think that aligns pretty well with the developmental stages. Hopefully you've done a good job of equipping them in those early years so they're not being caught flat-footed or surprised if they're being hearing this material in middle school or high school. But the bottom line is you don't do nothing. You do something, and you do it based on their ages and sort of the developmental stage they're in. And we talk a lot more about that in Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City.
Your co-author for that book, Stacey Manning, was kind of joking that it's kind of like your middle child book now because it's your second book. So it can be the one that's sort of getting overlooked, but it's such a great resource for parents. Yeah. So yeah, we definitely recommend that. All right. Another question, this one from Melanie. Can we really condemn people who are putting all their money and effort and time and their heart into trying to have children, whether they're using IVF or surrogacy or sperm or egg donation? Doesn't that indicate that they are going to be good parents and they really are going to care for them? How can we condemn that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it really does kind of draw upon a lot of the narrative around marriage and family in general that we've been hearing for decades. And, you know, I will put this in a couple different ways because I deal with these kinds of questions online all the time. Like, well, isn't it better that somebody would work so hard and spend so much money to have a child that's so planned? That's so much better than an oopsie. Oh, well, that was a mistake. Oh, a one night stand kind of thing. And I'll tell you the damaging effect of this kind of mentality. First of all, it sort of feeds into this idea that the child exists for me. Right? I get them when I want them in the way that I want them. And if I really, really want something, that's what matters the most. Second, it kind of feeds into this lie that love and money or resources is the most important thing to a child. It's not. Actually, we know the statistics, we know the factors that need to be in place for children to thrive. In fact, we know the factors that need to be in place for them to have wealth, security, love, stability. And it is their own mother and father raising them in a married, stable, low conflict relationship. I was actually talking with a researcher yesterday named Brad Wilcox, one of the top sociologists in the country. And he kind of destroys this myth of kids just need love and wealth. And he's like, well, you're not really going to get either of those if the child is born and raised outside of the married intact home. But I'll say the final thing is that a lot of the kids that were conceived through these technologies, especially the ones that were created using a third party, somebody else's sperm or somebody else's egg or somebody else's womb, they have heard since they could talk how loved and wanted they are, loved and wanted and planned and planned and loved and wanted and planned and wanted and loved. And the problem is that those kids have a deficit. They have a loss. They're missing half of their biological identity. They were cut off from their mother or father. Maybe they're growing up in a home without a mother or father at all because that's a single mother by choice situation, or it's two gay men. And then that you are loved and wanted serves as a gag order on their mourning and their feelings. Because you're so loved and wanted, you shouldn't be sad. You're not allowed to mourn. And so actually that you're loved and wanted has sort of been weaponized against these children. So no. Just because you love and want something, just because you're pouring resources into it, does not mean it should be something that is encouraged. What should be encouraged is defending and protecting children's fundamental right to their life and to their mother and father. Sometimes that's easy to provide to kids, and sometimes it comes at great cost to adults. But either way, we don't make kids sacrifice for us.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I liked what we've pointed out in some of our stories, that kids have been able to pick up on this fact that they were paid for, right? And there's been parents who've used that as a way to kind of, you know, it's the same way our parents would say, I brought you into this world, I can take you out. And there's parents that kind of say, you know how much I paid for you. So that's a really difficult thing for kids to have to navigate.
Yeah.
All right, this is a question from me now. I'm curious, you know, we had a recent story, another celebrity guy who identifies as gay with his partner, just purchased a child, you know, got an egg, rented a womb, and they have a baby. Okay. Cue the normal cycle, everybody affirming it, them limiting the comments of anyone who would disagree. And my question for you is maybe just some advice for all of us listening. What do you think we should do when we see these things come across social media, whether it's email or news or social media? Should we comment? Should we go start conversations or debate with people in the comments on their platform? Some people feel like that's really hostile. You know, don't come onto my platform, tell me things. Should we repost it onto our platform so we can make a comment? What do you think is the best way to sort of engage our culture in these topics?
Yeah, well, we're right. If you're coming from our perspective, if you're putting children first, if you're putting them before us, you are right. Your perspective needs to take center stage as far as I'm concerned. Part of that is going to be being the most educated, having the most facts, like being the one that is the expert on the topic. But part of it is doing whatever you can to remove barriers from people hearing your argument. So if I am commenting on like a major platform where, you know, it's a celebrity or somebody with an awful lot of social media following or power, I'm not too concerned about them. I know that I am going to be commenting for the purpose of educating everybody that's reading the replies and everybody that is following me. I'm going to use it as an opportunity to educate. But let's just say that you're on Facebook and it is a friend who posts something. If you then get on their post and start commenting, challenging on there, I'm going to say that there's going to be immediate defenses that go up. So I feel like that's a little more like busting into somebody else's living room and starting an argument. If you feel like you really want to say something, especially about a piece of trending news, I would recommend starting your own post, right? Tweeting your own tweet and making a positive case. And in that sense, you're sort of inviting people into your living room. You get to sort of set the terms for the conversation. And I think that then when people come in, you're a little in a better position to navigate, shape, adjudicate the conversation that flows from there. So with like major news outlets, I've got no problem getting on mainstream media and be like, you're victimizing kids. I like, you know, Gavin Newsom just posted something on his Twitter account that said, we've now subsidized IVF so everybody can have a, you know, access to children. And like, I just put onto there, you are subsidizing mother and father loss, commodifying children, leading to identity struggles, and making sure that children grow up in inherently unstable, unsafe households. This is a victimization of children at play. So I don't care about that, you know, and then you get like whatever, 2,000 likes on that. I don't care. I can go after Gavin Newsom. But if it's your friend that you really do have a personal connection with, I would say better to start a conversation on your own page than necessarily go in and start a fight on theirs. That's just my own personal opinion. But Jen, I know that you are also a very savvy sort of online culture warrior. So what's your thoughts on this?
Well, I think I've definitely honed it over time by doing it the wrong way sometimes and receiving some positive or critical feedback to sort of be better at it. But yeah, I think the same thing. I think moving it to your own platform is a really good idea, because then people don't really have the right to come in and tell you you aren't allowed to talk about different things. I'm careful when I repost things like on our Them Before Us account. If it's a big celebrity that has thousands, millions, way more followers than us, I totally repost it onto ours. I like to encourage our folks to go make a comment. I try to stay respectful, but go present the children's rights argument on someone's, again, public, they're posting it for public consumption kind of thing. I'm pretty careful. I wouldn't ever do that to, you know, someone with 100 followers who I'm a single mom by choice. I'm not going to light them up to our 10,000 followers kind of thing. So I agree. Putting in your own space, crafting how you want to talk about it is a great idea. All right. Final question from one of our listeners is, what do you do on kind of your average work day, Katie?
Yes. What indeed. Thank God I've got incredible staff that help me schedule, because there's a lot to get done. And if I had to work out the details and know every Zoom link and every virtual meeting or in-person meeting, I would be totally sunk. Right now, it's a little challenging for me because my husband is out to sea. He has recently transitioned to be a Navy chaplain. So I am solo momming a lot of the time. So to get everything done that I need to do, I wake up at 4:30 in general. Sometimes I have to get up at 4 if I need to get an extensive workout in before an early meeting. So I get about an hour of work done before anybody else wakes up. Then my 17-year-old son. So my two daughters are at college, which is crazy. Now I only have my two high school boys. So my 17-year-old wakes up. We work out together. Usually there's a little weight room or in our basement, or we go to the gym together. We get a good 45 minutes in of lifting. And then I come back, make breakfast for my 14-year-old son, who I get about 45 minutes with before I have to drive him to the bus stop. We get there about 10 minutes early and we read the Bible together. Then I head home, spend a little more time with my 17-year-old. We read the Bible together, doing two different books with each of them. And then he drives himself to school, which is delightful. I'll tell you, when your kids get to the driving stage, chef's kiss, baby. I tell you, it's a life changing. And then I work like crazy town. So today it's noon at the time of this recording. I've already done one meeting with our documentary team that is putting together a documentary with Focus on the Family, crafting that out. I have already done a nice, fantastic, long interview with a woman named Elisa Childers, who is a kind of Christian writer and podcaster that I love, Orthodox, fantastic. We are recording this, of course, right now. I am, after we get off with this, I'm going to do an interview with Scott Ray and Sean McDowell at Biola. And in between all of that, I've got meetings here and there with different supporters, different financial backers, like small and large. We're kind of in the middle of a fundraising campaign through the end of the year, where we are trying to close a $300,000 gap in our budget, because we went so big this year with new staff, new projects. We're about halfway there, which is amazing. So I spend a lot of time just meeting one-on-one over Zoom with donors from all across the country. And it is an absolute delight. I'm also very busy promoting pro-child politics. So I've got a business trip I'm leaving for tomorrow to go to DC to pitch that, speak at the Family Research Council's Pray Vote Stand. I'm going to keynote the Pennsylvania Family Institute's banquet. Both of them are going to center around pro-child politics. Do an interview with the American Moment, which is a fantastic outlet that I love. So also, you know, interviews at home with that. So a large chunk of my work time is pro-child politics related and making sure that we have all of the funding we need to advance the global takeover, because that's what this is all about. So thankfully, I've got incredible staff. Thankfully, my kids are all in a very good place. And I love that I've got enough time to give to them each day, really invest in their life, but then also advance this critical work of defending kids, both in the cultural space and in the courtrooms, in the political and the personal. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you guys next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.